time to tell me the truth, to burden your mouth for what you say, and pieces of paper in the way. 'Cause I can't continue pretending to choose these opposite sides on which we fall, loving you later if at all.
You are listening to Between the Lines, a monthly magazine show on the third Thursday of every month at 2 p.m. I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper. Brian Dwan is a multimedia artist whose artistic repertoire includes music. He plays the zither, the accordion, among many other instruments. He's a lyricist, a composer of both theatre and film scores. He's a furniture maker. He's a designer of album covers, and he does decorative painting. He creates film strips. He's a maker of musical instruments, including the analog synthesizer that he made with his cousin Leon Dwan. And he is a storyteller, a poet, and a singer. He's also one half of the musical duo Dwanatron, again with his cousin Leon, and he's played and toured with the likes of They Might Be Giants and Blue Man Group. He's appeared on The Tonight Show. His work is exhibited in numerous museums, and he has recorded several albums. He's been described as a true American original, an ephemeralist, and the thinking man's Jack Black by The New Yorker, no less. Also, he's an enigmatic jack of all trades and a Renaissance man. And I want to welcome the one and only and the very multi-talented Mr. Brian Dwan.
Hello.
You know, the more I read and learn about you and listen to your music, the more impressed I am. And there's many, many layers to Brian Dwan. And I'm really curious about your evolution as an artist. And I'd kind of like to start at the beginning by just asking you about your roots. And you're from Boston, right?
Yeah, I was born in Boston. I grew up in Lexington, Massachusetts. And my mother was from Boston, from Dorchester. And my father grew up in New York, in Queens. So,
can I ask what your origins are? I mean, what's the mix here?
My mother's side is Boston Irish Catholic, and my father's father was a Lebanese Jew. My grandmother was a French Catholic, and they raised my father a Christian Scientist.
Oh, that's an interesting mix. What did your parents do?
Well, my father was a physicist and worked for the Air Force. He worked at Hanscom Air Base in Bedford, Mass, and my mother is an attorney.
What were your influences growing up? Where did you go to college?
I went to college at Oberlin College, and growing up in Lexington, went to Lexington High. I grew up hearing, you know, varied things, certainly Beatles records. Edgar Varese, you know, was a favorite that my father had records of as a teenager.
I'm sorry, who is Edgar Varese? Can you just...
Edgar Varese is a composer who, you know, made kind of sculpted sound music. It's funny because in some ways he's the quintessential modernist, but he's not even a proper modernist. Sometimes people think of him as being famous for writing music that audiences would not tolerate, which I think is kind of silly because his music is very intuitive and has great feeling. It's not at all theoretical or something that you have to have a ton of prerequisite knowledge to appreciate. So he's a very... very kind of tangible artist, not something that's considered impenetrable or cerebral necessarily, but he, you know, he shaped sound, and he did some electronic music, but mostly orchestral music. And then I got excited about, you know, progressive rock as a young teenager, and still, you know, there's that influence of just the instrumentation, the Hammond organs, the Leslie cabinets, the Moog synthesizers, is a kind of instrumentation that I still love and that I use myself.
What did you play?
I grew up playing organ. My father played organ, and my brother Ted and I both grew up playing organ. So I started playing by ear, and when we were older, my parents offered us to have organ lessons, which we did, and I studied music at Oberlin. Got to study organ and composition, electronic music. It was kind of at the tail end of the analog era, so there were these wonderful analog synthesizers there that were great to use. Sometime in the mid-80s, I got a zither at a junk store in Wisconsin that I really fell in love with, and it had three courses of strings for every note, like a piano does, or like a hammer dulcimer does, and that has a particular kind of a sound that I became very excited about. And then in the late 80s, I made a big electric zither and started performing with that, singing songs and accompanying myself with that, and also a Leslie cabinet, which is a kind of speaker that has some like rotating horns inside that move physically in the cabinet and whirls the sound around mechanically.
And so, and you were in Brooklyn at this point, is that correct?
Yeah.
So you had moved from Oberlin down to Brooklyn after college?
No, I was in the Boston area briefly, where I had a job there briefly. And then when that ended, I ended up moving to New York and met up with some friends of mine there and didn't know what I was going to do and just picked up whatever sort of freelance work I could get. And there was a lot of kind of construction, demolition things, people renovating lofts, and they need to hire young people to put big garbage bags of cut-up wall-to-wall carpet with tacks sticking out of it out on the sidewalk illegally at 2 o'clock in the morning. So I was doing stuff like that, and just picking up odd jobs, freelance jobs of various kinds in New York, and then that became the pattern of what I knew how to do. So I did a lot of miscellaneous projects, and some of them were things I enjoyed or were creative projects and other things you do to make the dough. But most of the time I lived in New York, I didn't have a regular job or a salary job.
When did you start performing, and which came first, your performing or making an album?
I didn't do a lot of live performance until later on. You know, when I was a youngster, sometimes there would be an organ recital, but I didn't really do very much live performing at all, and I did do a lot of recording with friends, you know, making cassette tapes in a basement, you know, just whipping up stuff or making songs or, but we weren't ambitious to be a band. It really was just a very loose, informal thing, but we did a lot of things together, but we didn't play them out in live shows. It was really, we were doing it in order to record. So I had a lot of practice doing that. And then later on, it wasn't really until I moved to New York that I really started to do more live shows in little nightclubs or little funny theater spots in New York.
And what about your first album was when, in 93? Is that right? Or?
Yeah. Yeah, and that one was called Tells the Story, or Brian DeJuan Tells the Story. So those were some songs that I had been performing live, and somebody at Barnon Records offered for me to put out a record, and then I put out another record some years later. Well, I did a self-published record in 99. I licensed it to a label in 2001. That one's called The Operating Theater. These are songs that I wrote that use as accompaniment either the electric zither or auto harp or accordion and numerous keyboard instruments, organs, electric pianos, things like that. You know, songs that were made to be played and sung without requiring a whole group or anything, something that I could just render on my own. So those were original songs, and then later I put out the album called Words of Wisdom, which is entirely a collection of folk material, collected folk material.
But how did you expand your artistic repertoire? How did you get involved, for example, in the American folk song? What is it about that fascinates you?
Well, it wouldn't be limited to the American folk song, other than because I can only understand English, that limits it. And of course, a lot of American folk music has its roots in Irish or English or Scottish music or other parts of the English-speaking world. So that's what it really amounts to, although most of the stuff that I end up doing is American. Well, also, I'm interested in things that are kind of outside of... Well, now we're so used to what people refer to as mass culture, or something that popular culture only happens at the scale of mass production. And even in the era of mass production, there still are, you know, people making songs or creating things that are outside of the world of what can normally be published or put out or has currency in the larger culture. So I like a lot of those kind of slivers that fall between the cracks. And they don't even have to be that. There's so many wonderful things that are very famous, maybe that people are tired of and think of as cliched, and yet that's not an attribute of the song or the thing. It's just that people are tired of hearing it too much. So it's interesting when something that you've already, or you're already used to thinking as being something hackneyed or a cliche or something like that, that you may be surprised if you see it with new eyes and see what it's really made of. So some things are very durable in that way. And also things that go back into history or go back beyond our own time or our own lived experience. And I've for so many years been used to presenting, you know, folk material or old popular songs or any of this type of stuff. And people don't believe that it is old or that it is historical or from the period I said it was from, because it doesn't fit in with their idea of what people were supposed to think or feel. And they say, well, you changed all the words, right? And I say, no, I didn't change any of the words. And in fact, I did not change them. And I'm just starting on a new one that's called Sit, Stare, and Rock. That's the title track. And that one, that's a song from around 1950. And it's about the pleasures of sitting in a rocking chair and doing nothing.
What about They Might Be Giants? When did you tour with them? How did you get to know them? And also the Blue Man Group, which is a very different kind of group to They Might Be Giants. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, I met John and John from They Might Be Giants through a mutual friend they grew up together, and I went to college with our mutual friend Matt Hill, who's a writer. And so I got to know them, and I did a tour with them in 94, so almost 20 years ago now. You know, that was a six-week tour, so that was a long time ago.
And what did you play on that tour?
Oh, I brought around the zither and the Leslie cabinet and an auto harp, some fuzz boxes. And then the Blue Man Group, I used to play at a place called Dixon Place in New York. They still exist. They've moved around a bunch. And it was very small then. It was really just the founder's apartment. And so one of them asked me, he liked my instrument, the electric zither, and asked if I would play with them. And I said, okay. And eventually they said, we're going to do this six-month run in the Astor Theater. You know, are you up for playing on that? And I said, okay. So I did it for 7 months. So it was supposed to be done, but it never stopped. But I left back in 92.
Right, I'm just trying to think when I saw them, because I saw them was, I might have seen you in them, actually. I was living in New York then, and I went to see them when they were playing in the, well, it was, I thought it was Lafayette Place, but maybe it was Astor Place, where, because they had a residency there.
It's, and it still is, it's on Lafayette Street.
So who did you appear on The Tonight Show with?
Oh, that was the Blue Man Group. That was the pretty much the last thing I did with them. So we flew out there and did the show, did a little Blue Man spot on the show.
And who else have you played with?
Well, there's a group called the Raymond Scott Orchestrette. It's a seven-piece band that just plays the music of Raymond Scott, who was well-known in the 30s, is not well-known now, but everyone knows his music because it was quoted widely in the Warner Brothers cartoons of the 40s and 50s. We used to play a lot in New York. We didn't do a gig in 7 years, and then last year we did a Lincoln Center gig. We'll be doing another Lincoln Center gig on the 8th of August coming up. So,
And if you're just joining us, you are listening to Between the Lines, and I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper, and I'm here with Brian Dewan. And we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to listen to a track from his Words of Wisdom album.
East End was once a happy town, where harmony and love was busting out at all the seams, and in the trees above, the doves of peace were laying eggs. There were no signs of strife, for each man loved his neighbor and sometimes his neighbor's wife. But a sudden change soon come about. Storm clouds were in the sky. Nobody stopped to kiss a body coming through the rye. For each man eyed his neighbor with malice and with hate. Housewives no longer spilled the beans across the garden gate. We had a war, a civil war. Folks often asked us what we're fighting for. Well, most of us wanted water mains and sewers and bathtubs too. But the rest of them decided they'd make the slop pails do. It was sewer pipes versus slop pails. The town was split in two. With profane propaganda, the air was often blue. The sewer and water faction ran a sanitary plank. They said shallow wells and slop pails and toilets always stank. We had a war, a civil war. Folks often asked us what we're fighting for. Well, most of us wanted water mains and sewers and bathtubs too. But the rest of them decided they'd make the slop pails do. But those slop pailers were stubborn. They fought with tooth and nail. They said our nitwit council should be languishing in jail. They told how high taxation and plumbers' union fees would throw us in the poorhouse and they'd throw away the keys. We had a war, a civil war. Folks often asked us what we're fighting for. Well, most of us wanted water mains and sewers and bathtubs too. But the rest of them decided they'd make the slop pails do.
And if you're just joining us, you are listening to Between the Lines. I'm here with Brian Dewan, a multimedia artist and Catskill resident. Brian, talk a bit about the design side of your art. How did you start doing album covers?
I'd already kind of even started doing some book covers for a textbook publisher called Ginn & Company, and that was a sort of a funny outfit that they were making books that weren't typeset. You know, this is back in the days when people set out to the typesetter before computers, and you know, one of the jobs there was to do the paste up, sticking the text down onto the mechanical boards. And so I did some of that for them and then did some book covers. Record covers came when I don't think I had lived in New York very long when They Might Be Giants asked if I would do a cover for them. Originally, they were going to get somebody else to do the cover, and it bottomed out. And I said, well, you should just make your own cover. But they asked me to make something because they liked these constructions that I had made, and so I made something for that album for that came out in, when was that, in 88, I think? So that was the first one I did. And then later I ended up doing a gig with the Orchestra of St. Luke's. There was an evening of orchestral music by rock musicians. And so they needed a zither player for a David Byrne piece. And so I got the gig and was learning the thing. And then they, I think, found out that I did the They Might Be Giants record jacket, which I think Byrne had liked. And they asked me if I would do a record jacket, which I did. And then since then, other people have asked me to do them. So I've done some stuff for Julian Coster, who has a band called The Music Tapes. And also the Neutral Milk Hotel, Jeff Mangum and Julian Coster is in that band as well. And Kenny Siegel, who's here in Catskill, I did some artwork for him, some record jacket stuff. Beat Circus, Brian Carpenter's band. So it's something that I've done over the years, and that's something I really enjoy doing.
And so, and some of them are exhibited in museums?
Well, I've shown film strips in various museums, like I showed some film strips at the Brooklyn Museum and the New Museum, the Whitney, Modern Art Oxford in England, and the Museum of Jurassic Technology in Los Angeles. I don't know if you've ever been there. Wonderful place. And there's this tiny little auditorium on the second floor.
Okay, so you have to explain exactly what film strips are and how you came to start doing them.
Well, film strips are kind of a species of slideshow. It comes in a long ribbon of film. It looks just like the way a piece of 35mm motion picture film would look, except it's just rolled up and stuffed into a can, and it is not a motion picture. So a film strip projector, it was an economical way to have a slideshow that was made for educational purposes usually, also for commercial presentations. But it was not something that had an art tradition. It was more of a kind of a practical demonstration of something, and mostly sold to schools. So in that tradition, the stuff I make is kind of in that tradition, where it is, you know, educational or, you know, pedagogical, but mostly kind of an essay. It evolves into a kind of an essay or a poetical view that's trying to pass itself off as something objective. I guess they're not all that way, but that's a common thread in many of them. So the medium itself is a kind of school AV medium that is now considered obsolete or defunct. It's no longer the thing. I'm sure some schools still have them, but they really stopped being made in the 1980s. But it had been around a long time, because I think the earliest ones are from around, you know, 1912 or 1915, starting around then, and were used for decades. It was kind of a standard, and it no longer is. Although I think it's interesting, I meet young people who I would assume would never have seen it because that stuff wasn't around in classrooms, but a lot of people do remember seeing them. I remember when I was a kid seeing them, they were probably about 20 years out of date, the things we saw. But when you're a kid, you don't have a sense of that, and you just look at what you get at its face value. And then even the memory of that experience is a part of what I like to put into it, or to illuminate where we get our ideas of what is something that belongs in the modern world, or something that we shut out and say that is not a part of our world, it doesn't belong, and usually how irrational those conclusions end up really being, and doesn't really have to do how anything functions. It really has to do if it's in fashion or accepted, or if there's some sort of societal consensus about it. So these are things that always kind of stoke my furnace, so I don't get tired of that project. Sometimes they're straight-up narratives, too. Like, I did some Grimm's tales, the folk tales that the Grimms collected, and illustrated them. All of these film strips, the imagery is drawn, an illustration. And also I did an Old Testament text, some chapters from the book of Deuteronomy. And that's not something people read very often, so a lot of times people are shocked by it because they don't know what it is, or they don't know that it's a part of history, or that it is straight from the Bible. But it is a really wonderful text. So I even made a film strip once that was an industrial film strip. There was a company that hired me to make a film strip to show to an audience of their clients. And it was about package design before computers. And that was a fun gig. They pretty much just let me do what I wanted. And for a couple of years, I would go in and project it often. So that was, you know, the better part of my income for a couple of years doing that. And it was fun.
Yeah, you definitely, I mean, it's obvious that you have certain themes in your work. And we mentioned the American folk song. Also, you clearly love going back and resurrecting things from the past. And religion, you mentioned religion, that also seems to be another aspect of your work. How important is religion to you?
Well, it's always difficult to speak with people about religion because any word you can use is going to mean something different to every person. But it is important. And I think also there are many attributes of it that people embrace without knowing it. Or there's just so many different, you know, experiences that people have with it. You know, some very positive, some very negative. But also by its nature, it's not a world of systematic thought. I had a wonderful time reading The Little Flowers of St. Francis, the legends and stories that were collected about Francis and were really kind of finally codified maybe 100 years after his death. But, you know, you're talking about the late 1100s, early 1200s. So you're looking into such a different world than a modern person's world. And it's not a rationalist world. It's very intuitive and poetical. And you see what a very different world it was, just that historical period alone. And of course, in the stories, all sorts of supernatural occurrences take place. And I really like what Flannery O'Connor said in one of her letters about, she said, "I'm tired of people dismissing religion as being nothing more than bad science."
So there. You mentioned the museum in Oxford, and you're quite well known internationally. In fact, I read that the now deceased and much beloved British DJ, John Peel, whom I grew up listening to, was an admirer of your work.
I remember when I found out that he played my stuff on his show, and I was touched.
So what exactly did he play? Do you remember?
I know that he played a song called 99 Cops. I don't know if he played anything else.
John Peel had a very eclectic and quirky and excellent taste in music.
Well, he was definitely somebody who had a real breadth of knowledge about music and obviously was really deep into it. So,
yeah. And he informed the taste of the British teenage public. Yeah. I mean, we just grew up with him and loved him for decades.
Well, it's so great to think that a guy like him had a nice long career because he was like a proper DJ, which is to say a collector or a curator, and he was the one who filtered, you know, what he thought was interesting. And so he then concentrated things together because he saw fit to do so. And you don't really have very much of that now. There still are people who do that, but, you know, it's so different with the world of the monoculture of radio, for the most part, it's so highly standardized. And there was somebody who was from the world, like pre-standardization of this sort of thing. And he had the freedom to be a curator.
Yeah, and he made it into an art because he started off in the pirate radio ships and then ended up in the BBC, which is about as traditional as you can get. So. Okay, we are just going to take a quick break. This is Between the Lines. I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper, and I'm here with Brian Dewan, and we'll be right back. Thank you. And if you've just joined us, you are listening to Between the Lines, and I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper, and we're here with Brian Dewan, a multimedia artist who has a wide-ranging artistic repertoire. Brian, just to switch tacks a little bit, how did you come to be in Catskill?
Well, I lived in Brooklyn for 19 years, which I enjoyed very much. Towards the end, I was looking to lower my overhead and expand my workspace. And also a lot of things that I was in New York for were gone. All the places I used to perform were gone, closed, or just about. So if I wanted to get a good paying gig, I had to get out of town. Plus, I was still trying to make sculpture and do woodworking, and then it was hard to find another apartment where I could do that and make a mess and noise and fumes. So I just kept looking further out into other boroughs and into, you know, looking at Staten Island and Far Rockaway, and I came close to moving to City Island in the Bronx, but it just wasn't quite enough of a bargain, I thought, and I kept looking further out until I thought, well, maybe I can even try to buy something if I'm far away enough out. I was worried that if I left New York completely and was too far away, I wouldn't be able to make a living anymore because all of my work was word of mouth and from knocking around in New York. But I ended up in Catskill, and I'm glad I did. I like it here. And it was, I didn't know anybody up here when I came here, and kind of braced myself for that. It was actually more fun than I thought, having this new kind of solitary existence. I don't have a solitary existence anymore. But, you know, now I've been, you know, camped out here for several years. But it was a good change of scenery for me at the right time of my life. So I'm glad I ended up here and I've got my little house and I'm all set.
Plus, you've really arrived at a time when there's a thriving music scene in Hudson, of which you're very much a part of.
Yeah, there's so much more musical stuff going on in Hudson. When I got here, Hudson was already, well, of course, then the main focus of Hudson was the antiques business. And that's still a prominent part of it, but it's not focused on that so exclusively anymore. But there's a lot of music venues that you know, didn't exist yet, really, or have changed over. Like, well, now there's the new Half Moon over there, which were their musical performances. I'd never been there before in its earlier incarnation, but yeah, most of the venues in Hudson are new since I got here.
And you've played at many of them, correct?
Yeah, yeah. So I started out at the Spotty Dog. That's right, it was actually at a fundraiser for WGXC before it was on the air that I met a bunch of people like Liv and Jess, who were working at the Spotty Dog. And so they introduced me to the Spotty Dog, and I started to hang out there and to perform there. And I had a lot of fun, still have fun playing there. And now we have the Basilica and Helsinki. And there's some other things coming up. Well, there's also some performances out at CR10. In Linlithgow, that's an art space, but also performance, kind of an interdisciplinary type of place. And there are some other things that I hear about that are going to open, that are being fixed up. So there's a lot of places for it now.
You know, when you were just talking, you mentioned sculpture, and what exactly do you do? What kind of sculpture do you do?
Well, they're kind of architectural sculptures. They were things that I would make for New Year's Eve that were kind of like these edifices that looked like a cross between a building and a grandfather clock, and it would have a clock mechanism so that you could tell when it was midnight, and usually some kind of potion that you would drink at midnight or something like that. And I got started on that with an old friend of mine I grew up with, John Hardy. We made a few things together collaboratively, and then I continued doing those by myself over the years. So, you know, a lot of things that are kind of in the intersection between like furniture, architecture, or instrument console of some kind. And some instrument building stuff with the zithers, the electric zither. And then the work I do with my cousin Leon, he does the electronics, I do the console work. and then we think of how they operate, you know, together as analog synthesizers. So I just got started into woodworking to make these things that were sort of like miniature buildings almost, or if you will, like a grandfather clock. So I'll have a sculpture, an outdoor sculpture at Claremont, a show that opens in early August, and that's pretty much an outdoor grandfather clock.
What are you working on? I mean, it seems that you're working on all these different things.
Well, these are things done over the years, so sometimes I'll concentrate more on one than another or not do something for a while. I haven't written songs in a few years, but, you know, there's a whole batch of stuff that I wrote that I never recorded that I will record when I'm done with the Sit, Stare, and Rock record. So that's the project that's kind of next on my agenda after getting these other sculpture things done in time for some openings and some performances down in New York that I'll get ready for. This thing called the Accordion Summit that William Schimmel sponsors. It's something at the Tenry Center, which is near the New School. And that's something I do every year. That's always a fun thing to do because there's such a wide variety of things that are performed, but the common thread is the accordion. But it's all over the place with, you know, classical pieces and avant-garde things or traditional folk or pop or performance art or some whacked-out thing. So there's, you know, it's a variety show.
What are your current passions, if you like?
Well, if I'm listening to music, mostly what I'm listening to is either Renaissance music or medieval music, and also, you know, organ music. Sometimes earlier organ music. I do have a passion for modern organ music. Well, what was really a big influence on me was a French composer who's not that well known named Jean Alain that my father used to play. My father loved his stuff. He didn't live to be very long, but he wrote a lot of really interesting music. And it's kind of a, you know, it was written in the 20s and 30s. Harmonically, it's very modernist, but it's still kind of more in the romantic tradition. So it's an interesting kind of tonal music that's kind of way out and also often has religious overtones, but is, you know, kind of far out harmonically. And he was an enormous influence. But I haven't really been listening to stuff like that so much lately. Mostly just older music, and then sometimes just rummaging around, seeing what I can find in records, or now that there's YouTube, sometimes finding songs that I haven't heard before and stumbling into them.
And do you have a following? Who's your typical audience listener?
Well, I don't think I have one. I always think it's funny about the way people think of audiences, because audiences are always so different. Or when people say, who is your audience? I cannot identify an audience. Well, audiences are varied. And so I don't have a real sense of that. The audience is whoever shows up, and that varies. So, but, you know, usually it's people who are into storytelling, I suppose, or instrumentation. Yeah. But
and storytelling is huge today. It's become part of just about everything. Even in advertising now, everything is about storytelling in order to sell your product. Well, so you might be very much in vogue right now.
Well, it is kind of hard to think of it as something that can have a vogue because it goes so deep into human history that there's always storytelling is so fundamental in every generation. It's hard to think that it could be, you know, in vogue to tell stories, just like it's in vogue to eat dinner.
Well, if advertising can, they will find a way to make it in vogue.
Anyone who fashions any kind of a persuasion piece or propaganda broadcast or what have you, and that's also a medium that is fascinating to me, the arguments that people try to purport, or even the weirdness of the expectation that somebody listening to this spiel is going to buy it. You know, when I listen to the radio and hear, you know, various people are in the political world saying what they're saying on the radio, I just think, are you really that contemptuous of your audience that you expect them to buy that argument. But of course, that's what always goes on, and is, you know, there's a long tradition of you know, confidence men and their use of whatever razzle-dazzle show business storytelling or whatever they can exploit to manipulate people. But that's also a, you know, since time immemorial activity of human endeavor.
Again, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Between the Lines, and I'm here with Brian Dewan. We're going to be back after this short break.
In our day-to-day experience, it has always been concealed in the operating theater. It now may be revealed. I saw the glistening human heart lying in repose, so tender and so vulnerable, beating and exposed. The human heart is a lustrous thing, a wondrous thing, the human heart. Look at the patient lying open wide, it cannot hide the human heart. It has a passionate temperament, as everybody knows, gushing grandiose sentiments as a toilet overflows, throwing violent tantrums and prone to fits of rage. It can't keep still, it rolls around in its rib cage. The human heart is a preposterous thing, a monstrous thing, the human heart. Enlisting sympathy with vulgar sobs, it pounds and throbs, the human heart. And yet it lives for love and duty at its own behest, a lifetime through of work to do with ne'er a moment's rest, sustaining vital organs, anointing them with blood, devouting its vocation, a vital organ hoard. The human heart is an untiring thing, an inspiring thing, the human heart. Despite the heartaches of the rolling years, it perseveres, the human heart. What strange abomination holds fancy over fact? What Byzantine mutation would love what can't love back? What kind of freak of nature forgives a heinous crime and leads us towards as yet untraveled paths to the sublime? The human heart is an inscrutable thing, an immutable thing, the human heart. The human heart is an untiring thing, uninspiring thing, a preposterous thing, a monstrous thing, a lustrous thing, a wondrous thing.
And if you're just joining us, you're listening to Between the Lines. I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper, and we're here with Brian Dewan. And we're actually sitting in his charming house in Catskill, and one can't help but notice that you're something of a collector as well, Brian. You've got rather a lot of musical instruments and all sorts of other things that I can't even contemplate describing. So what exactly is all that out there?
Oh, gosh. Well, there's a few organs. There are rotating speakers. There are zithers. And a zither is really any kind of a instrument that has a lot of open strings that you pluck, and some of the ones I have a lot of strings. The electric one is the biggest one. That one has 88 strings. Auto harps have 36 strings. Then there's some other in between ones that you can see leaning against each other in the corner there. There's a kit harpsichord that somebody put together in the 60s that I got from somebody who didn't sell it in a yard sale and had to sell a house that had been in a garage for many years. So there's a lot of things that I've ended up with. I mean, a lot of things that were being thrown out. I don't think you can see it from here, but there's something called a Hammond Solo Vox that somebody was throwing out. A Wurlitzer electric piano, which somebody was going to get rid of. There was a time when a lot of these instruments were considered obsolete, and not just because they were heavy and that there were lighter things that you could tote to gigs, but because they were considered old-fashioned and therefore an embarrassment. And now they're valuable because they've become antiques. So it is funny always to watch as history progresses, how it people perceive the same thing differently, whether it's valued. And that's such a common cycle. Something is new and it's valued, and then it's old and it's people hold it in contempt, and then it gets older and then it is worshipped.
Right, that's what you were saying earlier about some of the American songs. And
yeah, and even the attitude towards, you know, medieval music for a long time was, you know, people in conservatories weren't interested in it, and it was considered a primitive artifact, but that was not really of interest musically, and was a curiosity. But I think a lot of people looked down on it, and that's very different than today's attitude about it. But that wasn't even that long ago. So it's always different. Just keep the ears rolling, and you'll have a different landscape.
Yeah. I mean, in fact, what we've got here is really a kind of mini musical museum in a way. Does everything work? I mean, do you keep tuning up all these instruments?
Not everything works, that's for sure. The harpsichord I did have in playing condition, but I need to replace some broken pieces of it to get it tweaked up again. I'm glad I did a lot of recording with it while it still was in good playing condition. So yeah, some of these things are fixer-uppers that you have to strike while the iron's hot when somebody's throwing it out, and it can take a long time sometimes to get around to sprucing something up. A lot of things often don't have a lot wrong with them. A lot of things are just caused by dirt. But not everything in here is operational, but a lot of it is.
And are you going to donate it to a museum, or are you just going to
open this
to the public, or what?
No, I've not thought that far. No, I guess that's another problem for another hour. But, you know, it's hard to fit any people in here.
I know. Yes, I had a problem getting in the door.
Yeah, so, that would be a challenge to have it be a museum. So we'll see. We'll see what happens.
So what is your biggest challenge as an artist, trying to survive as an artist today?
Well, luckily for me, because I did knock around in New York as long as I did, I was able to keep things going while I was up here. And then I even got a bunch of residencies over the years and went to England a few times and went to France. So really it's the same as always, as far as I'm concerned. You know, you do what you can to make some dough, and depending on what comes up, you know, some of it will be coincident with what you're interested in, and the ones that aren't, you get them done and you do some other thing. So there's never really any good visibility, but there's always enough stuff going on that I haven't had a dry spell in a long time. In the old days, I would maybe have a dry spell of getting freelance work and start thinking about how to break down and get a proper job. But a lot of that eluded me, and I couldn't get one. But then I'd pick up some other freelance work. And that's what I know. That's what I'm good at. So I'm just still doing the same thing as all those years ago. And you just have to cross that bridge when you get to it and not freak out until things have been dry for a long time.
And you still do a lot of carpentry work, is that right? Or cabinet making?
Yeah, or really any, you know, whatever comes up. I do over at the CR10 space. I made a little stage a couple of months ago and a bunch of benches and just maybe did some other handyman stuff there, like putting, you know, knobs on doors and things. So, you know, I do a bunch of miscellaneous things and opportunities come up and you hear about things and that's what I know how to do.
I have to ask you actually about the piece in the New Yorker. I mean, that's quite a coup to actually have a piece written about you in the New Yorker. What did you think of it? Did it make any difference? Did you suddenly shoot to fame because the New Yorker had written a piece about you and Leon actually?
Yeah, well, you know, it was a very visible thing, and people would say, like, hey, you were in the New Yorker. But, and the interviewer was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed him.
Was it Nick Paumgarten?
Yeah. So we had a good time in the interview, and, it was fun to have a little spot come out. Well, it's funny, because somebody else once asked me about the Jack Black business, but I don't feel like I can comment on it, because I haven't seen his movies. So maybe I should see them and know what they're talking about. I did hear him on the radio. I heard him, and I heard him sing. And I was impressed that he was a really excellent singer.
Yeah.
So I don't really know much about him other than that.
Yeah.
But I was very impressed with the strength of his singing. Yeah. I also thought that his singing was going to be more comedic.
Mm-hmm.
And even though there was something funny about it, it wasn't calm. It wasn't goofy. I thought he was really good.
Well, he's a comedian, as I'm sure you know, and he's a very physical kind of actor, and he's very, very funny. He's very endearing and charming, so...
Oh, I would like to check out his movies. I'm just behind on all sorts of things.
I would just like to thank you so very much. I'm sorry, we've got a cat between us now who's casting, who's...
Shedding.
So I want to thank you very much, Brian DeMant, for being on Between the Lines.
Sure, it was a pleasure.
The playlist for today was The Civil War from Brian's CD Words of Wisdom, Powerhouse by Raymond Scott, The Human Heart from the CD The Operating Theatre, and taking us out, Pollinatrix from the CD Dewanatron Semi-Automatic. You've been listening to Between the Lines. I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper. This is WGXC at 90.7 FM. Thanks so much for listening, and I will be back, as always, on the third Thursday of every month at 2 p.m. Thank you.
Thank you.